Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Both of us survived the second inauguration of Barack Obama, which, Jim, I don't think is a small accomplishment. We got four more years of this, unfortunately, but we will...
Every time I now have a tech issue, I'm always like, they're coming for me. You know? Sure, maybe the internet just happens to be down, or maybe Obama's making his move. Now, I made a comment like that yesterday and immediately said, well, with you right-wingers, we can never tell when you're being sarcastic. I don't think the Obama administration is lousing up my Comcast connection. Comcast can do that all by itself, you know.
Yes, they're quite accomplished.
Anyway, on that cheery note, let's say, isn't like terrible Islamist insurgencies our good martini for the day today, Greg?
Yes, it is. Welcome to the second Obama administration. As you all know, and this is not funny at all, there was a major terrorist incident / hostage crisis last week. The radicals in Mali spilling over into Algeria, attacking a BP gas plant in Algeria, taking a number of people hostage. We still don't have official numbers yet. The Algerian military then laid siege, dozens of people dead. As far as we know, all of the militants are dead, and so not exactly the outcome we would have wanted or probably would have had if American forces had been involved, and three Americans are dead, sadly. But the one glimmer of hope here is that the U.S. understands that this is not a problem that's going away in Mali. In fact, what we're seeing in reporting coming out of the Pentagon and elsewhere, Jim, is that they see this potentially as a new Afghanistan, staging ground for radicals. And if it's not dealt with in some form or fashion, as the French are trying to deal with it now, this could be an area where many horrific strikes emanate from. And we should point out that this area is much closer to the Western world than the last one was. And we know how successful some of the last efforts were out of Afghanistan. So not clear at all what the administration's policy on this is going to be. But the fact that at least there's an admission that the problem is there and it's real and they're saying it publicly is a good start.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stems from a very good article in the Los Angeles Times saying Mali conflict exposes White House-Pentagon split. And it basically says the Pentagon looks at this and sees if left unaddressed, they will attain a capability to match their intent, that being to extend their reach, to control, and to attack American interests. Army General Carter Ham, head of U.S. Africa Command, said in an interview. So the White House hasn't had a lot to say about Mali, hasn't had a lot to say about Algeria. And I think you could probably throw the, you know, seemingly ever-worsening situation in Syria, where Islamist militants appear to be getting the upper hand in the resistance over there. Here's three fronts in the war on terror. Just as the president said yesterday, a decade of war is winding down. Well, the al-Qaeda Islamist types have not gotten that memo. And they continue to be doing their efforts to gain control when they can. As somebody said, bin Laden is dead, but bin Ladenism, the philosophy he espoused, is not. And so the question is are they just going to be a regional problem for, you know, if you're an American working on a natural gas field out in Algeria, you take your chances and the U.S. is not going to come rescue you and you're on your own? I mean, if this is the new operating rules, it'd be nice if the administration would come out and say, look, we are no longer in the business of rescuing Americans endangered by Islamists abroad. Or, you know, maybe it sounds like the Pentagon wants to take a slightly more muscular and more aggressive approach to these things, recognizing that, look, Afghanistan once was considered far away and not much of our problem and landlocked and not an issue that was going to cause problems to us. And then we all saw what happened throughout the 1990s leading up to 9/11. So I don't think there's really any part of the map that we can concede to al-Qaeda. And when people talk about, oh, it's Africa, I mean, don't remember al-Waqi, the cleric in Yemen who was talking to the Fort Hood shooter? Far off lands can generate threats right here in the homeland. And it's kind of fascinating to see the administration kind of shrugging its shoulders. The good martini today is that the Pentagon is still on the job. And the fact that they're talking about this to the public kind of makes me say, okay, it feels like their warnings and concerns are falling on deaf ears at the White House. So they're going around it to kind of create public pressure to the administration to say, look, we cannot ignore this problem. It's kind of a fascinating dynamic to be watching for the next 4 years.
Yeah, and in the confirmation hearings for Chuck Hagel coming up at the end of the month, it'll be very interesting to see what his take on that is, and I'm not optimistic about what that take is likely to be. And it is of great concern because some of the threats coming from these Islamist groups after the French got involved in Mali, or at least announced they were going to, that sounded like their threats were not just headed towards you know, French folks and Western folks in North Africa, but potentially in France itself. So their reach might be larger than we wish it was. On to martini number two now, and we go from radical Islam to the golf course. And usually that's not the transition from good to bad, but in the opposite direction. But poor Phil Mickelson, lefty, the most popular guy on tour and has been for a long time. Obviously very successful. He's won 40 tournaments. He's won 3 green jackets at Augusta. You know, he finds unique ways to take himself out of contention sometimes, too. He got himself into the news in a different way at the end of the tournament in California early this week when he alluded to, didn't say anything real specifically about what his plans might be, but said drastic action might have to be taken as a result of higher and higher taxes for people who make as much as he does. And he lives in California. And so as a result of the fiscal cliff deal, his taxes go up. As a result of the referendum that passed in California last year, his taxes go up. Plus there's state and there's FICA and there's all sorts of other things. And he calculated, and his accountants calculated, that right now, given where he lives, he's looking at 62 or 63% of his income going to taxes at various levels. And so the fact that he mentioned this publicly got a lot of backlash from liberals. And now Mickelson's saying, well, this is a private issue, and I probably shouldn't have said anything publicly, but I still need to figure out what I'm going to do here because almost 2/3 of my income, despite all my hard work, is going to someone other than me and my family. So on a good side, Jim, Phil Mickelson is becoming a good face for this problem. But on the other hand, we're also seeing just how much of a problem onerous taxes are and the backlash now for people who dare to challenge it.
There were quite a few folks who had kind of responded to this of, oh, you're a multimillionaire. You play golf for a living. Stop complaining. Stop whining. You have a blessed life, yada, yada, yada. And I can understand that. We usually kind of roll our eyes when we see, you know, multi-million dollar athletes complaining about being underpaid and holding out for new contracts and stuff like that. But Mickelson is making a very legitimate point, which is that, look, he doesn't like having to turn over 62-63% of what he makes. And he says, look, if you add up the federal disability, unemployment, Social Security in the state, my tax rate's at 62-63%. Look, it's a free country, at the very least for, you know, for now, and he's free to leave California. This is a guy who apparently was thinking about becoming part owner of the San Diego Padres and who is basically saying, well, the heck, Texas has no state income tax, or, you know, Texas states have either low income tax or no income tax, like Florida. I know Louisiana is going in that direction. If we believe in federalism, then he can move to states that have, you know, lower tax rates and decide, hey, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm going to go there. There's a lot of people who speculated that when LeBron James moved from the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Miami Heat, the difference in income tax rates between Ohio and Florida made a big difference. You know, look, your tax rates create an environment of whether people are going to want to live there or they aren't. And, you know, I think one other part that we can aspect of this we can point out is that California does not appear to be a terribly well-run state. And so if you're paying, you know, this and gobs of money to Sacramento and you see corruption scandals and towns with sheriffs retiring with full benefits after being on the job for a year and all these kinds of stories, you look at it, it looks like a basket case, a banana republic. So look, Phil Mickelson's got every right in the world not only to make the move, but to say to the public, here's why I'm making the move, to kind of be the canary in the coal mine for people in California to say, look, you know, you may not notice a guy who owns a chain of dry cleaners or some other job like that moving, but people will notice when a celebrity like Phil Mickelson moves. And, you know, certainly the golf community will. And it kind of says something that, hey, taxing the rich, which always is this feel-good popular maneuver, has serious economic impacts, and it makes the rich people leave the state. And, you know, that's at some point you may get it like Gerard Depardieu, folks who decide to, you know, renounce their citizenship and move somewhere else because they feel like the government's taking more than it deserves out of their paycheck.
Just so folks can leave the day on a happy note, we move to martini number three now. And usually the crazy martini is just that, something bizarre, off the wall, or sometimes outrageous in a way that infuriates us. This is crazy awesome, as Jim put it in one of our emails exchanging this morning. Prince Harry leaving the front lines from the war in Afghanistan as the coalition is obviously winding down, if you've been paying attention to the news. And Harry is more than happy to admit that he has killed Taliban figures in his different missions. He's launched missiles, he's taken them out, and he is more than proud of his work there with his colleagues in Afghanistan. And Jim, this is great. Not only is he actually proud of killing the enemy, because he should be, that's why we're there after all, but this is a guy who could have easily figured out a way never to be anywhere close to the front lines, and he was there.
Yeah, there's kind of two interesting thoughts about this. One, for certainly almost all of my lifetime, you read about monarchs of Europe, once being very powerful figures, you know, changing the course of history on the continent. And then you looked at, you know, Prince Charles and the drama over Fergie and Lady Di and all this stuff. And this kind of sense of, like, they became like almost Kardashian-like celebrity figures. I remember somebody over in Britain saying, why do we have a royal family? Well, if we didn't have one, what would we have to talk about? That they were mostly figures for gossip and really frivolous social commentary and things like that. Here you see this guy, besides the fact that everyone loves the new royal couple. Here's Prince Harry, who, yes, he's gotten a little bit of trouble in Las Vegas or something, but who is, you know, not just doing a for show bit of military service, but actual serious military service. Apparently he works in a helicopter gunship, and he, you know, openly says, look, now I've killed Taliban. You're looking at that and kind of marveling and kind of realizing, you know, there were some people in Great Britain and United Kingdom who were shocked by this. And there was a columnist who said, why are we surprised by this? Why do you think the purpose of the military is over in Afghanistan? They don't send royal invitations to the Taliban. They go out, they fight, and they fight wars, and they kill. So first of all, a pint of warm beer to Prince Harry for serving his country. And kind of to observe that a royal family that's sometimes been known for scandal and you know, bad behavior and stuff like that. I mean, I just observe regarding that Las Vegas thing. Look, I'll forgive a lot of bad behavior for a guy who puts his life on the line for his country. And obviously, you know, Prince Harry, good on you. And, you know, I think the British people have a member of the royal family they can be quite proud of.
Great paragraph here from The Sun in the UK. The 28-year-old confirmed that he had killed deadly fanatics from the controls of his Apache helicopter. Quote, if there's people trying to do bad stuff, then we'll take them out of the game. I think that's George W. Bush type language there. Very clear, very succinct. Nobody misunderstands what you're saying.
It does, but in his, you know, to give credit where it's due, Greg, it sounds so much better with a British accent. It sounds so much more dignified and refined, and, you know, it's almost witty in the way he says it. So.
That's right. Very good. Probably didn't say doesn't. Or anything, you know, anything like that. But Jim, good to have you back. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Good to be back, Greg. I'll see you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Wednesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.